drink from the cup in your hand, lay back against you and breathe, feel your heartbeat.
Hello there, and welcome back to the Vacation Bible School Podcast. My name is Jason Kirk, and we are joined by...
Emily Kirk.
Tremendous. How are you today, Emily?
I'm good. How do you do?
I'm doing okay. Okay. We are, on this program, working our way through the books of the Holy Bible, story by story. There are, you know, a lot more stories than you might think, judging by how quickly we had anticipated advancing through the Bible and how slowly we have done so. But it's dense material, it turns out. There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
We are approaching halfway through the book of Samuel. I think to this point, this is the one that has felt most like trying to digest an entire novel rather than like a list of this person did this and this person did this. And like everything is very character based and just lots and lots of peopling it up throughout.
And if you had told me that we would spend so much time covering Samuel, I would have been like, huh? But because you just think about David and Goliath and that's it. And then, yeah. No, there's so much. Well, I mean, it's still David, but
yeah.
There's a lot of David.
David isn't even king yet. That's how much of the book of Samuel we have yet to get through. And he won't even be king by the end of this episode, unless he's the king of your heart. David shouldn't be.
He's the king of someone else's.
Yeah, Jonathan is worthy of being the king of your heart. David, be careful with that guy. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. So if you are just now tuning into the show for the first time, this is not a show where anyone is going to try to push any particular flavor of any particular religion on you. I have no idea if I count as religious or not. I sure used to. Whereas Emily, you are still as religious as ever.
Sure. I just go to church a lot less. But yeah. Now I podcast about it.
Yeah, that counts. So
every 6 months or so.
We have heard from folks who've said, like, our marriage counselor said we had to attend a religious service. So I told them about this podcast and they were like, yeah, sure, that's fine. So if you need like some sort of a doctor's note, so like to tell your teacher, your boss or whoever that, yes, you are at church, fine, feel free. Please tell them that you attended this podcast.
I have a tangent about marriage counseling, because when we thought we were going to be married by, you know, your infamous former pastor.
Right.
In that church, they required marriage counseling through the church, which we went to, I think, one session of with this woman. And I don't really remember much about that session, but I remember when we decided, okay, we're not getting married here. It was like, okay, we don't really care if you go through marriage counseling anymore or not.
Yeah, it was just like, if you want to use our facility, then the state of your
marriage matters
in the eyes of the Lord is important. But otherwise, who cares? Because you will surely just get divorced like all the other atheist scumbags of the world. And that's like how long we've been married, basically, is the story began with a plan to get married in a Southern Baptist megachurch. And now look at us.
Now I won't step foot in that place.
Yeah, now we don't really prefer to go anywhere near it. So, hey, we're speaking of love and marriage already. So, the following story is one that is up for all sorts of interpretations. And what I have already said is the opposite of what you would hear if you heard about this story in Sunday school. I know many a Sunday school youth has encountered the story of David and Jonathan and said, these guys are really, 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 really good friends. Is there anything possibly else going on there? And the answer in a large number of denominations would be no, of course not. But I think by the end of our tour through these few chapters in the middle of the book of Samuel, I think you'll be convinced it's open to interpretation at very least. Emily, as a youth, did you really ever encounter the story?
Nope.
Sort of the story in between David and Goliath and King David?
No, I don't remember ever hearing about it. But I also, I don't know, I don't remember it, but maybe that just means that if they thought there could be multiple interpretations, we're not going to open that up to our children.
Yeah, let's just hope the kids don't discover it.
Maybe. I don't know.
The story starts with David the Goliath killer, and we also have this other guy, Jonathan, Prince Jonathan, son of King Saul. Two episodes ago, he was Israel's greatest war hero. Remember, he did the commando surprise across the valley into the Philistine camp and all that stuff, and it sort of made made Saul freak out because Saul's terrible at thinking on his feet. So here we have Israel's two greatest living warriors, and they meet. And in a story like this, what do we have? Maybe there's an instant rivalry, right? Maybe they're like, no, I'm in charge. No, I'm in charge. I'm the tough guy. I'm the tough guy. There is a different kind of story where there is an instant something else. There is an instant connection between these two. So Emily, we start off in Samuel chapter 18. In most Christian Bibles, it'll be called 1 Samuel chapter 18. Emily, can you start this chapter off for us?
Sure. When David finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Saul's warrior son, Jonathan, was bound to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul.
So if you are a Sunday school kid and you read that, you think, that sounds different from how I think about my platonic friends.
Yeah. Even like best friends and things, people that are like your ride or die. I don't know if that's how you would describe them.
Not typically. I don't know if many rap songs that include.
This is like usually reserved for like spouse or child level love.
Yeah.
I would think.
Yeah. So right here, there's sort of this notion, and you can see it, you find it in some commentaries. You certainly would hear it from a lot of pastors that like, oh no, this is just how they talked about friendship back then.
But they don't do that anywhere else.
What, anywhere?
Talking
anywhere
about friendship, right.
Anywhere else in the Bible.
Right.
Yeah, because we've seen friendships, and we've seen oaths, and we've seen business transactions. We've seen political alliances. We haven't seen a lot of two people expressing love for each other this passionately. And we've seen marriage stories. We've seen Genesis is full of a boy and a girl meet at a well and fall in love stories. And still, it's not referred to with this kind of language. So there is endless debate about what loved means here. Were they just extremely good friends on sight? Were they the kind of extremely good friends who get referred to by certain historians as just extremely good friends? Like this is sort of a history trope, right? Where it's Alexander the Great. He had a extremely good male friend. That's like this thing historians say where it's like, okay, but are you sure that's it, right? Or is David and Jonathan, and this is often what you'll hear from like official conservative commentarians, was this just sort of political bond vow? Because, you know, remember, biblical love often means devotion more than affection.
If their names were not specifically male names, like if you didn't know the genders of these two names, there would be no question what kind of story this was.
I think you're right. Like if it was David and Junia,
or yeah, just two names that weren't specifically male or female, I think people would be like, well, who are they first? Or they'd just be like, oh, it's a love story,
right? Yeah. So like, you know, it is possible. It's certainly possible, and in fact, as we'll see, it's definitely part of the story that there is a political bond here. And there were ancient contracts where people swore to love the king. The commandment, love the Lord your God, means be loyal, not blow kisses at the sky, despite what you might hear in praise and worship songs in evangelical churches, Jesus is my boyfriend music. But, you know, at the same time, biblical love means that, you know, that like committed devotion, but it also includes like Jacob adoring Rachel, right? So like biblical love can mean a lot of things. And there's another key word here, which is soul. We think of soul because we live in a post-Greek world where like soul means like the ghost that lives inside your skin. But as the theologian Samuel Terrian reminds us, soul at the time is especially, you know, in the Hebrew world, is a word for your entire being. So Jonathan's soul love David means something like Jonathan's entire body and soul love David. And in fact, loved as his own soul, as scholars Sylvia Schroer and Thomas Stobley note, sounds in Hebrew like he whom my soul loves from Song of Songs. Do you know the book of Song of Songs? If we are referencing in any way Song of Songs here, we have hit peak biblical romance. Like, you know, and it's not a definite connection. There are scholars who say, oh, you know, you're looking too closely into it. It says loved as his own soul, loves with my soul, right? When we talk about love and soul, anytime anything in the Bible sounds anything like Song of Songs, we are probably not talking about platonic friendship.
And I don't think the word soulmate was around yet, but this is basically a soulmate.
Yeah, could be. Yeah, like this.
That's when people are talking about their souls and love, you're talking about soulmates, whether you believe in that or not. That's what this reminds me of.
It's yeah, I mean, that's probably a pretty good argument, I think. It seems like to me, especially because I know how the rest of the story goes. Remember these two might have, like, seen each other for a while. So, like, it's not necessarily either love at first sight or extremely intense friendship at first sight. Like, they could have been very aware. David would be a legend. And he'd been King Saul's court musician for a while, meaning, you know, Prince Jonathan surely saw him before then.
Well, and he'd been around Saul for a while at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though Saul seems to forget that at times.
Right.
David is often around.
Yeah.
Also, the Bible made sure to tell us at that time that David is very handsome.
Yeah. And the story doesn't read like an introduction to between these two. It just kind of picks up in the midst of it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like it reads as if there is a bit of familiarity.
Yeah. Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that he was wearing and gave it to David and his armor and even his sword and his bow and his belt.
Yeah, so like people really try to argue these two soulmates, at your word, one of whom is so beautiful even Goliath is impressed, and the other of whom is already taking off his clothes and handing over all of his phallic-shaped weaponry, were really just good platonic buddies. I reading Song of Achilles and, you know, even just the Achilles and Patroclus story from high school or college or whatever, like, reading Song of Achilles the entire time I thought of David and Jonathan. It's the story of the Greek super warrior superhero Achilles and his sidekick lifelong best friend Patroclus, and they are very much in love with each other. And you know, every time in that story it's told from Patroclus's perspective, this novelized version, and he's constantly thinking about how beautiful and impressive Achilles is. And the entire time I was thinking, you could just change the words and this would be Jonathan talking about David, if you made Patroclus like a pretty mighty warrior himself. People have been noticing since at least the Middle Ages how much David and Jonathan sound like Achilles and Patroclus. And this is like the fourth episode in a row where the Book of Samuel sounds like Homer, sounds very Greek, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, actually, I was just thinking about that because I feel like when you were talking about the phallic weaponry, how it feels like a time like in ancient history where they have like the big shared baths and things like that. That was the type of thing that crossed my mind. And it's like, how can you say that there were no gay people back then?
Sure, yeah.
Because there definitely were.
Why would we design a society where everyone bathes together, right, if people weren't attracted to each other? Lots of people have also argued this sounds a bit similar to Gilgamesh and Enkidu. Susan Ackerman argues in her book When Heroes Love, the David and Jonathan story sounds even more romantically charged than Gilgamesh and Enkidu. The entire book is about those two stories and about like all the, at very least, potential romantic connections you can see. And like, yeah, there is political context here. Like anyone who says this is merely a political alliance, like, okay, yeah, there is a political alliance here. Jonathan's clothes are royal. He is handing over his princely garments, so to speak, and, you know, maybe not even aware David's already been anointed as the next king. But at the same time, he's also just plain taking off his clothes for his canonically very handsome oath-bound soulmate. Like whoever wrote this exchange of political alliances, that author noticed that one of the guys is handing over his sword that is shaped like a part of his body. It's not an accident that that's in the story.
Did you and your friends ever do this? Undress in front of each other and hand each other clothes and phallic weaponry?
We should have. And honestly, we were very into pro wrestling, and like pro wrestling is incredibly homoerotic at times, like whether it really knows it or not. So
I think they know it.
yeah. Like, I mean, so I don't know. There might have been times where it's like you sort of look up and like, oh wow, this would appear very intimate. But I assure you, we're trying to beat each other up. But I can't say I recall anything quite this soul stirring in my time as a youth.
The women came out of all the towns of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines and songs of joy. And the women sang as they made merry, Saul has killed his thousands and David his 10,000s. Saul was very angry. He said, what more can he have but the kingdom? So Saul eyed David from that day on.
Yeah, everyone's eyeing David.
Yeah.
So remember the last episode when Saul's first act as king, or two episodes ago, when Saul's first act as king was to be greeted by some women singing in the streets? Now he's just seen women singing about David instantly outshining him.
And Saul is now a bit older, and he was also very handsome, but very stupid in his days. So there's probably a bit of that like youthful jealousy going on.
Yeah, he's jealous because like he was merely a himbo, whereas David is him. I also love that these women are described as coming out to meet King Saul while singing about how David's better. Like, hey, boss, have you heard the good news about this guy who's mathematically 10 times better than you? Like, either they don't realize they're dissing him to his face, or they don't think he'll pick up on it because he's very stupid. And there is one of Saul's very first moments from 3 episodes ago or whatever was women speaking very slowly to him because they realize he's stupid. Women thinking Saul is dumb is part of the story. And to be fair, Saul is dumb.
The next day, an evil spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. Saul threw his spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. But David eluded him twice. David's so smart.
David's so smart and such an athlete. Saul should have seen Goliath's spear being useless against nimble David, right? And here he is using a weapon that has already failed, right? Saul's really dumb. The evil spirit from God thing, it's sort of an ancient term for like a bad mood. It doesn't mean Saul was demon possessed or whatever. It's just sort of like, why was he acting like this? I don't know. something spiritual.
It's like Scooby-Doo gang when the bad guys are constantly trying to outsmart the gang and never happens. Oh, get those kids.
Yeah. I would have got away with it if David hasn't killed 10,000.
Saul was afraid of David, so Saul removed him from his presence and made him a commander of 1,000, leading the army.
So not only does Saul assume David will try to kill him and take his kingdom, even though David's already anointed but isn't making aggressive moves, Saul sends David out hoping he'll die in battle. Remember how Saul is learning from Prophet Samuel, the guy who was terrified of sharing power and always playing games with his rival? Let's come back later on and see if David learns from Saul's move here, being jealous of someone and sending him out to die in war.
It's funny too, because even if he thought David might die, he had to have the thought that he might not die, and I've just made him an even bigger leader.
Yeah, possibly, but when you say Saul had a thought, that might be reaching too far for our boy here.
David had success in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. When Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in awe of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David.
So it's pretty significant here to mention both Israel and Judah, because like the story to this point hasn't really brought up the split kingdom thing. But as we'll see from now onward, those two don't really end up agreeing on a whole lot, except for David is pretty cool.
I just think the part is funny where it's Saul was in awe of him, and it's like I can picture him like standing in his door with his hands on his hips like, are you kidding me?
He's killing 10,000 more guys.
Then Saul said to David, here is my elder daughter. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought, I will not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines deal with him. David said to Saul, who am I and who are my kinsfolk, my father's family in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?
So first, I like that Saul is saying, fight the Lord's battles, right? Like, the Bible's authors are very aware that people in power often use religious motivations to bullshit people into doing what they want.
My, how times have changed.
Yeah, this was surely the first and last time that ever happened. So David, he's saying, who am I? I'm not worthy. And it's like, I don't know. It is David just being humble, or as Ackerman and fellow scholar David Damrosch argue, is David trying to turn down the king's daughter because he already prefers the king's son?
Clearly. But at the time when Saul's daughter should have been given to David, she was given to someone else.
And what do you know? King Saul breaks his oath. First time for everything. It would be nice to know whether that woman had wanted to marry David or this other guy. But hey, here comes a verse about what a woman wants.
Now Saul's daughter, Michal, loved David. Saul was told, and the thing pleased him. Saul thought, let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore, Saul said to David a second time, you shall now be my son-in-law. And David again claimed to be unworthy.
So if I came to you and I was like, listen, there's this guy I hate. I'm going to give our daughter to him in hopes that she ruins his life. Would you think that's a good plan? What kind of a fatherly plan is that? Using your daughter as a weapon?
But he's not very smart. He doesn't know.
So he doesn't know that's terrible. He's too stupid to figure out extremely basic morals.
I mean, probably. That's what it sounds like. Then Saul said, I desire no marriage present except 100 foreskins of the Philistines.
Foreskins back!
So weird.
So,
obsessed with foreskins in the Bible.
So this means we are now on an 8-book streak of Bible books with weird dick stuff, which before we counted that streak because of the golden tumor rats way back at the very beginning of Samuel, but now it counts no matter what that was actually referring to. Also, David's story keeps sounding like Samson's. If someone had slid the story into Judges and they're like, someone told Samson to cut off 100 Philistine foreskins so a lady would marry him, that would be the best day of Samson's life.
I mean, that wouldn't take up very much space. Did he just like put him in his pocket to bring him back?
I mean, he might have had a big bag, a wheelbarrow.
I don't think he'd need that.
It's light on details, which really lets the imagination flourish.
I just don't get why they were all so obsessed with collecting foreskins.
It's like the ultimate insult for a Philistine, because if they're viewing, like, if you're circumcised, you must be one of our enemies.
Okay. When the attendants told David he was pleased to become the king's son-in-law, before the time had expired, David brought their foreskins in full number to the king. Saul gave him his daughter Michal as a wife.
So, like, yeah, like you were saying, how did he store these things as he collected them? Was there a time limit?
He said before the time had expired, so clearly there was a time limit.
What was the time? Was there a scoreboard clock?
I just like that it said he brought their foreskins in full number. Wasn't one shy.
Don't you worry. You can count them in front of me. I would love to watch. Don't you worry. I assure you they are all there. I have not kept any for myself.
What if he got extra?
I mean, maybe any bonus were just like, these are my own personal trophies. So to this point, I think the five most romantic things that have happened in the Bible, basically I like chronological order, Eve and Adam sharing fruit, Jacob working many years so he could marry Rachel, Moses and Zipporah saving each other's lives, Jonathan getting naked for David, and David handing very mentally ill King Saul a bucket of confiscated foreskins. Those are the five most romantic things that have happened to this point.
Do you think that David, like, what was his motivation for trying to marry Michal at this point instead of Jonathan?
Well, I think at this point, because, like, he's exclaimed about, like, being the king's son-in-law, you know? And scholars have noticed this. David keeps saying, like, oh, I'm unworthy to be, you know, to be a son-in-law. He never said, oh, how excited I am to marry Michal. It's like David just keeps repeating and reiterating and focusing on the son-in-law becoming a prince thing, you know?
And then it was like he could have his private relationship with Jonathan that wasn't so private.
Then I get to live in the palace along with Prince Jonathan. I don't know if they lived. I don't know what the royal court proximity was.
Who knows?
I get to live in the king's castle. Mm-hmm. No, there wasn't a castle.
But when Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that Saul's daughter Michal loved him, Saul was still more afraid of David.
So, like, yeah, like you're saying, there is a valid interpretation of the story where Israel's greatest hero was engaged to one sister and married another, all while being soulmates with their brother.
Well, and clearly Saul, once again, thought that the Philistines were going to take care of David so that he wouldn't come back with these 100 foreskins, but that didn't go his way either.
Yeah. I honestly sort of think what makes most sense here is that Michal is kind of in on it. She knows, like, my brother's in love with this guy. My dad, who is extremely violent and has a huge temper, will not be a big fan of this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to marry David to cover for my brother. Like, I think it's a valid reading of this story. And then, you know, people came along hundreds and thousands of years later and said, like, oh no, this every family in the Bible is just one guy and one woman and that's it.
Yeah.
Never mind, like, you know, a sister marrying a guy to cover her for her brother.
Saul spoke with his son, Jonathan, and with all his servants about killing David, but Saul's son Jonathan took great delight in David. Of course he did.
Sure, who doesn't? Look at him.
So Saul is, like, super oblivious if he hasn't noticed the relationship that they're, like, soulmates at this point and all that. Even if they really were only best friends.
Right.
That you didn't know this about your son.
Yeah. To this point, there is sort of this rising tension as you're like, when's Saul going to figure this out? Going to figure out, if absolutely nothing else, that his son and his rival are best friends, right?
Well, to me, this adds a little bit more credibility to the fact that they weren't just friends, because a friendship wouldn't have been something that would be hidden.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the only things they would have to hide would be if they were actively conspiring against the king, which, like, they haven't, we don't really have any inkling of that, or if there was some sort of, you know, other forbidden element to the relationship. Like, David over and over hasn't really done anything to, like, trick Saul.
Right.
Jonathan took great delight in David.
Jonathan lit up when his father mentioned David's name.
Here's the thing. Like, why is Jonathan about to take the big step of defending David to his father? Is it because of a boring secret political pact? Well, there goes the secret if he's going to defend him to his father's face. So here's the thing about the word delight, which the Bible argues is the entire reason Jonathan is about to defend David. Ackerman argues the word for delight means something like lust in Genesis, Song of Songs, and Esther. So Jonathan, according to one linguistic interpretation, is doing this because he is in love with David.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan told David, "My father Saul is trying to kill you. Therefore, be on guard tomorrow morning. Stay in a secret place and hide yourself. I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak to my father about you. If I learn anything, I will tell you."
So Ackerman also points out David got married like three verses ago to someone in King Saul's family, yet the person he's sharing secrets with isn't his wife, but Jonathan.
Jonathan spoke well of David to his father Saul, saying to him, "He has not sinned against you. He took his life in his hand when he attacked the Philistine. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against an innocent person by killing David?" Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan. Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death."
So for the second time, after the honey oath debacle two episodes ago, Jonathan is the voice of reason who gets Saul to change his mind.
Do you really think he changed his mind, though?
Momentarily, at least. It's not much of a mind in Saul's head, so it can really roll around in there. You never know where it'll end up. And yeah, let's see how long he keeps his word, if it makes it through this entire next paragraph.
David beats the Philistines in battle again. Then an evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand while David was playing music. Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he eluded Saul so that he struck the spear into the wall. David fled and escaped that night.
So this is now four times spears have been useless against David, most of them by his father-in-law. This is a thing in ancient literature, swords, bows, spears, these are phallic weapons. Why did Goliath think he was going to win? Because he had a real big one. Saul, as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand while David was playing music, is Saul just jealous? Is Saul jealous that his song boy prefers Jonathan?
It's weird to me, though, that David just keeps showing up. It's like he's rubbing it in his face, like, "You're not going to kill me." Because early on, David eluded him twice, and all of this has happened since then. David had to know something was up because he wanted him to marry his daughter, but he'd already eluded him a couple times. Like, he keeps sending him to these weird battles and to collect foreskins. Like, this is weird.
Yeah, like, David, we know he's smart. He outsmarted Goliath. We know he knows Saul wants to kill him, but he keeps showing up.
Yeah.
What keeps drawing him there?
It's not Michal, because they don't even talk about her hardly.
Right, she just sort of exists. Hey, here comes her action scene.
Oh,
here
good,
we go.
Good. Saul sent messengers to David's house to keep watch over him, planning to kill him in the morning. David's wife, Michal, told him, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." So Michal let David down through the window. He fled away and escaped. Michal took a human-sized statue and laid it on the bed. She put a net of goat's hair on its head and covered it with the clothes. When Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He is sick." Then Saul sent the messengers to see David for themselves. Saul said to Michal, "Why have you deceived me like this and let my enemy go so that he has escaped?" Michal answered Saul. He said to me, "Let me go. Why should I kill you?"
So this sounds like Jericho, the book of Joshua, when double agent Rahab is hiding her Israelite spy James Bond lovers, then lying as they run away in the night. So this is a story type within the Bible. This could also be Michal knows that story, so she's using that lesson. Note she lies twice, saying David is sick and then claiming she had to let him go because he threatened her. She's on David's side, though it could be she's on his side until she's the one in trouble. But either way, she covered for him and got him out of town.
Now David fled and escaped. He went to the prophet Samuel and told him all that Saul had done. Saul sent messengers to take David. When they saw the company of the prophets in a frenzy, with Samuel standing in charge of them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also fell into a prophetic frenzy. When Saul was told, he sent other messengers, and they also fell asleep into a frenzy. Saul sent messengers again and again, and the third time, and they also fell into a frenzy. Then he himself went, and the Spirit of God came upon him. He fell into a prophetic frenzy. He too stripped off his clothes, and he too fell into a frenzy before Samuel. Is that a five iron frenzy?
This is a three wave frenzy of
There's a lot of frenzying going on.
Army men constantly catching the Holy Ghost.
So what does a frenzy look like back then? That's what I
mean. I assume it's just very Pentecostal, just like it does these days. So, like, Saul's sending, like, wave after wave of dudes into, like, to try and kill Gandalf, who's guarding David. This is good. So, like, not only is David God's favorite special unkillable boy, he's protected by, like, a guy who's already established as being, like, very powerful. And Saul's like, I'm gonna go down there and shut down this charismatic revival. And then, like, unfortunately, he's, handling snakes until the 1 o'clock NFL games are already done. And, like, oh gosh, Saul, you really walked right into that one. Also, King Saul and Prophet Samuel, they've been rivals for, like, 19 VBS episodes, and here they are reunited. Boy, I wonder if they will meet up again. They probably will.
Saul lay naked all that day and all that night. Therefore, it is said, is Saul also among the prophets? So laying naked makes him a prophet.
This is, like, what a really good punchline. A few episodes ago, we learned, is Saul among the prophets was a saying that meant something like, is there a bull in the china shop? And now we see how ridiculous it looks when that saying is literal. Like, the king is rolling around naked. He doesn't even know why. He's too dumb to know what he's doing.
He was in a prophetic frenzy.
everybody getting riled up on worship music and ending up in a big cuddle pile is a real danger, as rookie youth pastors often find out when they send everyone out to sing and hold hands and cuddle in the camp. And, like, oh, look, they're all riled up on Jesus. You know, yeah, well, they're riled up. I'll give you that much.
David fled to Jonathan and said, what is my sin against your father that he's trying to take my life? He said to him, far from it. You shall not die. My father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. And why should my father hide this from me? Never. But David also swore, your father knows well that you like me, and he thinks, do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, there is but a step between me and death. Then Jonathan said to David, whatever you say, I will do for you. David said to Jonathan, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king at the meal. But let me go, so that I may hide in the field. If your father misses me, then say, David earnestly asks leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. If he is angry, then know that evil has been determined by him. You have brought your servant into a sacred covenant with you.
So David calling himself your servant is a way to display humility. It's a thing lots of Jews still say to this day. It's also him displaying his allegiance to Jonathan, something Jonathan keeps doing for David, meaning they are very much in this together. Also, scholars point out the person David keeps running to isn't his wife, but Jonathan. Like, he's only once even attempted to see Michal, as far as we know.
Yeah. Well, and the sacred covenant.
Yeah, I don't know. I've been told many times marriage is a sacred covenant.
Yeah, I haven't been told that about friendship.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard that about, like, just two guys who like to stand around together.
And also, I mean, I know that, like, there are families and that have problems and stuff like that, but when you're still, like, in with your family, like, Jonathan is in with Saul and his sisters at this point, they're not, like, estranged, and he's choosing David over his father.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that says a lot.
Yeah. So, like, yeah, it's a political alliance. Yeah. It's a royal, there's royal intrigue.
But there's also no promises of future, political gain from this. So, usually, if that's the motivation, you're going to hear about it.
Yeah. Like, David never says, make me king and you'll be my number two in charge. Also, what would that do for Jonathan? He's already number two in charge.
Right. He already has a sure thing.
Yeah.
He doesn't need that from David.
Yeah.
Jonathan replied to David, come, let us go out into the field.
So, Schroer and Staubli argue, a secret meeting in the field sounds like Song of Songs 7:11. Come, my beloved, let us go into the field. And again, if you find yourself referencing Song of Songs while talking about a Bible story, you should think about that fact.
In the field, Jonathan said to David, if my father intends to do you harm, may the Lord do even more harm to me if I do not keep you safe. Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own life.
Seems pretty clear to me.
Once again,
it seems clear what the story is about. Jonathan's insisting David will be fine, but a lot of commentators point out Jonathan might not know about all the times Saul's already tried to kill David, the spears and the military promotions and stuff, which would mean, you know, is David, maybe David can't believe Saul is stooping to this level, you know?
I think it's funny too, like all the times that Saul has tried to kill David, and some of these times David probably didn't even realize that's what he was trying to do, and he still won.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny.
Yeah. Yeah. The dangerous military promotions is probably like David's just like, oh, cool, a challenge. I get to kill Philistines.
Yeah.
Like it's nothing to me. It's easy.
Jonathan said to him, go hide. When the time comes, I will shoot 3 arrows near you. If you hear me telling my helper my arrows are near me, then you're safe to return with me. But if you hear me say, the arrows are far away, then we'll have to part. May the Lord be between you and me forever. That sounds like a marriage.
Exactly. These words are used in wedding vows, particularly between LGBTQ Christians and Jews. And there are other words in the story of David and Jonathan that have proved extremely meaningful for people in, you know, in a variety of marriages. And like, I don't know how a lot of like platonic friendship stories that have words that you can with zero effort turn into marriage vows, you know?
I don't know. I just know that people got big mad at me on a Facebook meme, Christian meme thing, because I argued that David and Jonathan were gay.
Yeah. It strikes a chord when there is a story that can be interpreted enough ways for like different kinds of people to see themselves in the story. You know, like, why would you feel so possessive of the story of David and Jonathan that you wouldn't want someone to be able to look at it and say, like, hey, there is a place for me in this overall story. I'm represented in this story. There are people like me in here, you know? And your answer might be, well, because this other verse, I think it says that this is bad and wrong. Well, first of all, no, it actually doesn't. And secondly, like, as you know, as we keep saying with the Bible, the tricky parts, the bad parts, the things that you think it forbids, compare them to what's in the stories.
There's a lot I don't understand about what does it affect you if Jonathan and David are gay? How does that change anything for you?
Right.
It doesn't.
Yeah. All it did is introduce a question, introduce a complication. Like if you're a person who holds that the entire Bible says that, you know, all LGBTQ people are living wrong, we're made wrong, we're created wrong, we're born wrong. If you're a person who thinks that, then the fact that it is not hard to interpret multiple stories as being about LGBTQ people, that is a thing that you should sit and think about instead of dismissing.
Also, I don't understand how that becomes the thing that people are mad about and not the fact that like David married someone he didn't care about or love.
Sure.
Like there's so, you know, it's always about the sanctity of marriage, but there's so many marriages in the Bible that like completely go against that.
That's a really great point. Like if the story of David is about the sanctity of marriage
and traditional marriage,
okay, there's a marriage here that is not very sanctified, right? Because David doesn't care about it all that much and he abandons his wife to her angry father, right? Like, yeah, there's a marriage here. It's not a model for anything, nor are David's subsequent marriages. The only relationship David has in his entire life that exemplifies the things we say we are going for is his relationship with Jonathan. It is the only pure, good, holy, wonderful, loving, trusting relationship in his entire life.
By day 2 of the feast, Jonathan has used up all his lies about why David's missing. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. He said to him, you, son of a rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? Says the man who was just rolling around naked.
Right, which means he's probably still embarrassed about that.
And here we go, blaming a woman again.
So, yeah. So, you mentioned, does Saul not notice that, like, his son seems to be in love with David? So, like, when Saul finally blows up, notice the language he uses. He calls Jonathan a mama's boy. He says, you've chosen that other boy to your shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness. His mind is going constantly to femininity and sex. Like many scholars have pointed out how Saul's rant includes those references and a reference to Saul impregnating Jonathan's mother, like Saul presenting himself as like the big masculine, manly guy. And why would he be doing that if he wasn't upset about what he believed their relationship to be? And if you're a person who is arguing that David and Jonathan are doing something wrong, you sound like King Saul, one of the last people in the Bible you should want to sound like for any reason.
Yeah. And this is a classic example of like what people do when they get mad and they just start like yelling and picking out the person's, what they are, their perceived flaws. You just start yelling about those things. So this is part of that, just like what every narcissist does.
Yeah. Yeah. You just you list out all your own insecurities, filtered through what you believe to be that person's flaws, right? It's like Saul is embarrassed because he was just caught rolling around naked. He's fixated on nakedness, and that reminds him of, yeah, so many other things. So one thing about the verb in Jonathan chose David, Ackerman notes that's the same verb as in Genesis 6:2 when angels chose women as wives. The arrow thing, when Jonathan is firing arrows as the signal, right? Obviously, it's pretty obvious. What's it shaped like? Ancient Near East scholar Delbert Hillers says bows and arrows were practically unequivocal symbols of phallic masculinity. And there'll be another David and Jonathan archery reference next episode. Also, this story, Jonathan is a soldier with weapons, and he is able to shoot arrows in such a way, you know, accurate enough that they can serve as signals to his ally out in the field. This story frequently presents Jonathan as a masculine soldier, not as David's helpless sidekick. Jonathan was the war hero two episodes ago. Now he's defying an evil king with weapons of war. Soon he'll fight in another war. If we read the stories being about a gay couple, then it is a story that fiercely challenges one of the assumptions made by ancient writers that a gay relationship will somehow require one of the two men to become weak. Both these men are strong. I guess people don't expect the Bible to be subversive about things like that, but it's right there on the page, and it, you know, you can interpret it however you want. I think it is completely valid to interpret it the way we are.
Saul said, "For as long as the son of Jesse lives upon the earth, neither you or your kingdom shall be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die." Then Jonathan answered his father Saul, "Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" But Saul threw his spear at him to strike him. Jonathan sprang up from the table in fierce anger and left.
So Saul is 0-4 on spear throws.
He's really good at this.
And like, what an extreme moment. He tried to kill his son.
He's so mad. Yeah.
And like, notice the, he's saying, "You'll never be king. You'll never be king." Jonathan doesn't care about being king. There's something Jonathan wants more than to be king.
Yep.
And Saul cannot conceive of that. Saul cannot conceive of love. Saul cannot conceive of wanting to live for something other than being powerful.
In the morning, Jonathan went out into the field. Jonathan said to his helper, "Run and find the arrows that I shoot." As the boy ran, he shot an arrow behind him. When the boy came to the place where Jonathan's arrow had fallen, Jonathan called after the boy and said, "Is the arrow not beyond you?" Jonathan gave his weapons to the boy and said to him, "Go and carry them to the city." As soon as the boy had gone, David rose from beside the stone heap and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. He bowed three times, and they kissed each other and wept with each other. David wept the more. Then Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, since both of us have sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord shall be between me and you, and between my descendants and your descendants forever.'"
So I feel chills every time. I feel a little bit misty every time. Scholar J. Cheryl Exum points out the contrast between David's passionate goodbye with Jonathan and David literally bolting out the window while leaving his wife. Yes, there are plenty of Bible moments about one man kissing another man as a polite greeting, but this is emotionally charged. David's even sadder about their parting than Jonathan is. Noteworthy because David didn't seem to care at all about leaving Mahol. As far as we know, Jonathan is the only person David loves, and reading ahead in the story, it's possible that's true for his entire life.
Well, also when he's talking about the Lord shall be between me and you and between my descendants and your descendants forever, like he's talking about their children and how the whatever children they have is because of the love that they have for each other.
Yeah. And like, it sounds like a number of movies where like two people know they can't be together. They know they will have to have families elsewhere. I'm thinking of Portrait of a Lady on Fire, and I'm thinking of Brokeback Mountain, where these people know they have to part. They know they will have to have these other lives, but they hope there will still be some sort of a connection forever. So the scholar Damrosch notes, quote, "This relationship has been developed so far beyond anything that would have been required simply to assure the audience that David and Jonathan were close friends." Next episode, David will call Jonathan greatly beloved and call his wonderful love greater than the love of women.
Also, I feel like a thing that they would say if they weren't going to be like, "Oh, they were just friends," because I don't know if the word friends existed in that way yet, but be like, "They loved each other like brothers."
Sure.
You know, that's a thing that's often said that would have clarified the relationship completely.
Yeah, if the author had wanted to do that, right? And this story was written, you know, and like, we don't know how many rounds of writing and editing and how many rabbis saw it, how many scholars saw it, and how many, you know, scribes and so on and so forth. Like, this story might have existed for decades or centuries. centuries before it became finalized. Surely at some point in there, somebody was like, hey, should we clarify anything about these guys? But they didn't. It remained open to interpretation.
Also, if it were edited down, that means there was more to the story.
Yeah.
They surely did not take out the parts that called them friends.
Right. They didn't take out the parts where one of them was like, ew, don't kiss me during our passionate goodbye.
They didn't take out the parts that clarified the relationship was a friendship.
Yeah. So we could say, like some Bible commentators, that their relationship is mostly a business covenant. But so are lots of biblical marriages between men and women, which are often mostly about economics or politics. And, you know, to be clear, there are lots of scholars who argue lots of things about this story, and plenty of them do so without homophobic agendas. And lots of them argue one way or the other while agreeing it's open to interpretation. I'll be quite honest. I acknowledge it's possible to interpret this story as just two guys who were friends. It feels like a stretch. It feels like a reach.
If you read this and this was your first time ever hearing this story and you hadn't already been told.
Right.
You would think this was a gay relationship. And that goes for, I would say, most anyone reading it. So, like, if you gave this story to a current conservative Christian, changed the names and updated it, made it more modern, they would want it banned.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, what if you just changed the names and told him it was from, like, some country that they think sounds bad, you know?
This would not be allowed to be read in schools.
Yeah.
In Florida and Tennessee and many
other change the names and say it's from, just invent a Muslim country that doesn't exist and see if it gets banned from schools, right?
Yeah.
So, the things in this story that everyone agrees on. One ancient rabbi said, if love does not depend on some selfish end, it will never pass away. This was the love of David and Jonathan. And the Spanish mystic Saint John of the Cross, whose work is beloved by LGBTQ Christians, said, the love Jonathan bore for David was so intimate that it knitted his soul to David's. If the love of one man for another was that strong, what will be the tie caused through the soul's love for God?
Just in case it wasn't clear by now, a primary theme of this episode and of basically all our episodes is that it's okay and even very good to interpret ancient stories not just according to what makes the most sense, but also based on what they have to say about us as individuals. Sometimes those interpretations are going to be at odds with the official decrees handed down by people with political agendas. And if those agendas are queerphobic or any other kind of oppressive, then those agendas deserve to lose. With all that in mind, let's bring on a guest, Mason Meninga, to talk about not just Jonathan and David, but about a few ways to interpret lots of things about God. We'll also talk, as always, about Tooth and Nail Records. Apologies once again for audio quality, and I think after this one, I finally figured out how to record with guests.
So just for a bit of background here, this show is, it's sort of a spinoff of a college football podcast. If you're a brand new listener to the show, you might wonder how that could be. It's a long story. But this show did not set out to do like sports jokes or whatever. I don't know those. It's a religion podcast. And yet we can't stop bringing on college football players by complete happenstance. Michael Felder, former UNC defensive back, was on our Noah's Ark episode.
Oh, wow.
And now Mason, I learned literally days ago after inviting him on the show, Mason was a college football player.
Wow.
An NAIA level. Yes, I'm extremely good at avoiding college football. NAIA wide receiver at a reformed school in Iowa that recently won the NAIA national title. Do I have that right?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, the NAIA is like almost just a step above high school. So, you know, a lot of people, when I say that I play college football, they're like, oh, wow. Like, you know, did you almost make it to the NFL or whatever? I'm like, I know one guy that got tryouts. actually, we played against a guy that got drafted. That's kind of cool. But he played at Iowa for a number of years and then got kicked out and then went NAIA because he probably wanted to take steroids or something and ended up making it to the NFL. But anyway, that it's not like we're D1. I was a D1 athlete by any means. I was not that good.
I'm sure you were awesome. And it was more just like the Lord's calling led you away from football. Unlike Warner.
That's why you didn't.
How did you even find about that? Were you like Googling me or something? Like, I feel like that's like in the pits of my Google history at this point, because it was so long ago.
It was during the FCS title game, South Dakota State versus North Dakota State, when we were DMing about the game. And I was like, wait a second, Mason's a South Dakota State fan. What is that all about? And then it's like, wait a second, because like, I knew you're a football fan, but then like, it was looking up South Dakota stuff that I realized, like, this is an athlete I'm discussing.
Did that for a while. It was a big part of my life. I was one of those weirdos in high school that would ask for lots of training things, like, you know, the like parachutes that, you know, you would run to, you know, for resistance and all the training things you can think of. I had, and then I had a, when I was done with football, I had a little CrossFit phase for a while, and actually was doing a number of competitions. I never like was even close to going pro or anything, but I did do competitions quite a bit.
Nice. Well, you know, if you're into CrossFit, I happen to know
a guy
from a few years ago who was fit for the cross because of your sins, Mason. And I can,
and only mine.
So speaking of like religious guilt and stuff, Reformed College, was that like the was that the path at the time? Because I couldn't help but notice it was just a few years between Reformed College and like very not capital R Reformed Calvinist.
Yeah,
Mason.
Yeah, I sometimes describe myself as a negative 5-point Calvinist these days. So interestingly enough, my like whole questioning of my faith happened at that school. It wasn't like I was galvanized even more as a Reformed person going to that school. It was really like right away at the beginning of my freshman year that I started to read people like Brian McLaren and Rachel Held Evans and Nadia Boltz-Weber and all these people that, you know, a lot of folks who have like quote unquote deconstructed or whatever that they read. And so I started reading those folks almost 10 years ago now, and immediately was like, oh, this is the kind of Christianity I want to be a part of. This is really interesting and way better than the conservative evangelicalism I had grown up in. And so it was like all throughout college that I really got involved in that world, reading all those books, and I was a youth ministry major, so I was writing theology papers all the time. And so that was the kind of theology I was really interested in writing about. And for the most part, my religion professors are very supportive of it. I don't think they really understood it or anything, but they were all very supportive. They were not like the Reformed dude bros you would typically think of at a Reformed school. And in fact, my youth ministry professor was this older South African woman. She was like really close to retiring, and yeah, she was like this South African feminist woman. She was great. And so yeah, it was just kind of a weird place to be in while that was all happening. But what's most interesting is where this school is located. The county is statistically the most conservative county in America. Okay. Wow. What I mean by that is, like, in 2016, when Trump got elected, I remember caucusing where, you know, there was like 20 Republican candidates at that time. Trump got like sixth in that county. Like you have to be like Mike Huckabee, or I'm trying to think of like all the very conservative Christian people. Like, you have to be like a very conservative Christian to win that county and the caucus. And at that point, Trump was not that person. I think Ted Cruz might have gotten like second or something, but that like tells you how conservative it is. It's like even Trump was not conservative enough for them, or not conservative Christian enough for them. It's also the county that I don't think he's official anymore, but Steve King, do you know Stephen King? Mm-hmm. He's like this, he has connections to the KKK and shit. He like would speak at my chapel. Let's just put it that way. So anyway, it's all weird that like that's where I was doing my deconstructing, if you will.
It sounds like you sort of found like a handful of oases, like in multiple kinds of very conservative world.
Yeah. And the weird thing is I didn't grow up particularly Reformed either. I grew up in it was technically United Methodist. It had the total vibe of like a non-denominational church. It wasn't very reformed at all. So it was very much in that like Arminian vein, like very Francis Chan. That was a person that I grew up with a lot. And it wasn't until I went to Northwestern that I really got a whole dosage of Reformed theology. I did have a short John Piper phase in high school. That was kind of the closest I got to being Reformed growing up. And I remember the whole like predestination versus free will debates. And I would say most of the people in my church were much more on that free will Arminian side of things, just because it was a church, I guess, rooted in the Methodist tradition. But again, it wasn't like the Methodist thing really mattered that much to my church. So, I kind of had like little like bits and pieces of Reformed world here and there. And then obviously, again, I got a lot of that in college. But yeah, so and then I also, outside of that like Arminian Reformed dichotomy, I also had really, really significant experiences in high school and early part of college at this very, very Pentecostal church on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And so this was like a little tiny church, like maybe 20 people show up. The pastors were not theologically trained at all. They were just people who wanted to be missionaries on the res. And, you know, they would wear their basketball jerseys preaching, and like, and there's cockroaches running across like this gym floor and like that, and exorcisms happening. Like that was my experience at this church. And that was also a very different world, super charismatic. I didn't really grow up, the church I grew up in did not have like much speaking in tongues stuff happening, but this Pentecostal church obviously sure did. And so, yeah, I kind of got all these little like bits and pieces of this, of the conservative Christian world, at least the Protestant side of things, you know, with being in a very much an Arminian world, going to a college in the Reformed world, but then also getting like the whole Pentecostal flavor as well. So yeah.
Yeah, you sped run Protestantism right there. That's pretty much
pretty much. Yeah.
So just to make sure the listener is familiar with the work you do, because you do a handful of really interesting things that are related to sort of our overall general topic here. One thing that we've talked about with number of guests is Christian music that we grew up on and or still appreciate, which is always there's always a little bit of nostalgia and a little bit of cringe and a little bit of everything else.
Right.
Folks, Mason is the co-host of the Black Sheep podcast, one of my favorite music podcasts, where they interview mostly heavy music folks, metal, hardcore, etc. From, I guess, the Christian and Christian adjacent world might be a decent way to
And Guar.
And of course, Guar. Christian adjacent. The Bible's got a lot of gore and stuff.
Christian adjacent in the sense that like they were like they're like the demons that are talked about in the Bible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, you know, Jesus died for Guar too, as I understand it.
That's right.
So with your vast knowledge of Christian metalcore, which I realize it feels like, wow, what a niche thing to be vastly knowledgeable about. But no, this is very important, folks. This is highly respected knowledge and wisdom. When you think back on like sort of growing up and now and bands you're still into, what are some artists that stand out for you as like, I guess maybe that most sort of fit your journey along the way, if that makes any sense?
That's a good way to ask that. Yeah, so I grew up obviously listening to all that. You know, the first music I ever knew growing up was VeggieTales, obviously. And then just because when you're like 6 years old and you can't really make choices for yourself, the only music I also grew up listening to was like Michael W. Smith and Stephen Curtis Chapman and all of those folks, Newsboys. But it was at the point when I like was allowed to go on the internet without my parents like hovering over me watching what I was doing on the internet. That's when I was able to start exploring the Christian music I was interested in. And obviously, all of that was like tooth and nail, just because it felt like a rebellion against the Stephen Curtis Chapmans of the world and the Newsboys of the world. And so, yeah, I just really got into a lot of tooth and nail and solid state stuff. And so that meant, you know, Under Oath and Hawk Nelson and Norma Jean. I'm trying to think of Amberlin. And then obviously even outside of the Tooth and Nail world with Switchfoot and Reliant K and some of those bands. in terms of like kind of accompanying me on my journey, you know, my first favorite band ever was Under Oath. Like they were one of those bands that I remember hearing initially was a little like, this is weird. But then very quickly was like, this is my favorite band. And it was around that time that they started to blow up with like Define the Great Line. So I was in kind of later part of my elementary years. And then they were my favorite band for quite some time. And in high school, I very quickly became the number one Chariot fan. That's the band we've interviewed the most. We've interviewed a lot. I mean, they also have like a million different band members. And so actually we'll be interviewing another one here in a couple of weeks. And so the Chariot still to this day is my favorite band of all time. But it was also in high school that I started having some doubts about my faith. I still was, I would say, very conservative in my faith, but I started realizing like, oh, I like don't think about that thing theologically or politically as my church does. And that's where like I started getting into that John Piper phase where, you know, growing up in that Arminian world, I was like, well, what if I'm not Arminian? Maybe like I think about and still it's like funny to think I was like questioning my faith, but I was at, like I was basically going from like an Arminian side of things to like a really reformed conservative dude, bro. But the way I think back to it is like that was me questioning my faith. Like there were questions and doubts I had about the Arminian theology I was growing up with and was immediately attracted to the Reform world. But even beyond that, like the political side of things, I started having questionings around like, you know, I still think homosexuality is a sin, but why should the state say that they can't get married? So then I kind of had this like whole libertarian phase where I was also like this Reform dude bro as well. So yeah, there were like just these questions that I started having. I still also had like a lot of questions around purity culture. Obviously being like a high school boy, I was like, this is not vibing with what I'm feeling in my body. And so I just started having a lot of these questions about my faith. And it was when I got into college that I started encountering other Christians and the way that they think about some of these questions. So all that's to say, back when I was in high school, having these questions about my faith, the album that really just sticks out to me that I listened to a lot during that time was Come Now Sleep by As Cities Burn. Just because there's so much doubt in that and just so much honesty in that album from Cody Bonnett. And yeah, I just was at that time really resonating a lot with it. So yeah, that was kind of those years. I'm trying to think if there was like albums in those early years of college that was like, there were albums I really liked. I'm trying to think if there are albums that like accompanied me on that faith journey. I don't know if there were like any albums that have like accompanied me since then, but there are artists that I've just gotten into just because I like artists over those years. But the album I can really think that really accompanied me, that really kind of catalyzed a faith switch in my life, was that As Cities Burn album, and still one of my favorites, probably my favorite album ever to this day.
I think it's a great answer because like there was this thing in that whole world, like Tooth and Nail adjacent, kind of from MXPX onward, where like these bands were wrestling with the same thing that their listeners were wrestling with, right? Mm-hmm. Like this music was marketed to evangelical adolescents, and the bands themselves were evangelical adolescents who were like born with it. And like, you know, they all had so many ways of reckoning with it. Like we're not a Christian band, we're Christians in a band, and you know, all the variations of that. And like, as they found ways to talk about it, at least for me, and I know for others, it provided a way for us to talk our way, you know, out of what had been put in our brains.
Yeah. And I think Under Oath is probably the most like classic example now of one of those bands that like kind of left Christianity or left evangelicalism at the least. And yeah, you see so many now that, and I hear it all the time on the podcast list, talking to some of these artists, and yeah, so many of them at the very least have left evangelicalism, if not left Christianity altogether. And it's just really interesting. I have a whole theory around why we see that more prevalent in that Tooth and Nail solid state world than we do in like the CCM world. And I really think it just comes down to, at the end of the day, a lot of these artists were legitimately really good artists that cared about the scene of music that they were in, whether it was the heavy music scene, the punk scene, hardcore scene, or whatever. And those scenes of music kind of just by nature are going to be kind of anti-authoritarian. They're going to be counter to some sort of like hegemonic culture like evangelicalism. And because of that, I think a lot of those artists felt this tension of, okay, do we still remain hardcore? But then that means that we're going to have to like compromise and not be this evangelical thing anymore. Or do we just commit ourselves to this evangelical thing and we're going to have to then compromise being this hardcore? And we've seen it happen both ways. Like we see Under Oath that are like, no, we're actually just, we really love the hardcore scene and we're going to remain that. And they leave evangelicalism. Whereas a band like Skillet totally could have like leaned into that hardcore side of things that they came out of initially. I mean, they were kind of in that like new metal, hardcore alternative world early on. And you see throughout like the 2000s and the 2010s of them like really committing to the whole like evangelical thing. And that's why you also hear the music just sounds different too. Like it, they move away from like that really edgy alternative sound to now this very generic pop, almost like an Imagine Dragons type of sound. And I think like that sound and your commitments politically and theologically, they seem to be really in line. And you see that happen both ways, I think. So anyway, that's my kind of theory around it of why we see it more prevalent in that kind of tooth and nail solid state world than we do in the CCM world.
That's a really interesting theory. I think Skillet is false metal. That's what I'm hearing. And that's why they are doomed to wander the Christian nationalist wastelands with their pro wrestling entrance music. You also have a second podcast that is also related to our subject at large, People's Theology, where you interview theologians that I think a lot of Christians, mainstream people, they might not think of people from these backgrounds as likely being theologians, because so many of us are raised to think of like straight white guys with beards and pointy hats as those are theologians, right?
Right.
And you talk to women, LGBTQ people, people of color, you talk to, you know, a wide range of people who have a wide range of thoughts about God that like, you know, everyone should be listening to. And so sort of related to that show, I wanted to ask you for our listeners to explain a small handful of concepts that feels like they arise frequently in your work.
Mm-hmm.
One being liberation theology, something that we touched on briefly a time or two, and I feel like is kind of impossible to avoid, especially when you're going through like the story of the Israelites and then later the story of Jesus. But liberation theology at this point, how would you define that idea?
Yeah. So liberation theology started in the 1960s in Latin America. At that time, Latin America was being colonized or was colonized by lots of different European empires. And the indigenous people, the people from Latin America were fighting back against those imperial powers. And a lot of them were Catholic, and they started developing these theologies around God being on the side of people who were being oppressed. And obviously in their case, they were the ones being oppressed. And so, yeah, they started having these ideas about God and, you know, what does salvation look like? What does evil and sin look like if you're a person who's oppressed? And then, you know, a lot of those themes they concurrently happen with Black people in America. And so James Cone is often thought about as like the founder of Black liberation theology. So you get, you know, this Black liberation theology, and a lot of Black women were learning from James Cone. They were students under him. And so they started kind of like, you know, there's critiques that we have of James Cone's work because he's a man and he doesn't think through the lens of like as a Black woman. So a lot of these Black women started developing their own kind of liberation theology, and they call it womanist theology. So at the end of the day, it just is this theology that's done from the experience of someone who's oppressed. And so, you know, that means we have liberation theologies, obviously a Latin American liberation theology. We have a Black liberation theology. We have a womanist liberation theology, but now we have a queer liberation theology. So there's a number of queer theologians that do that kind of work. I know some of my favorite theologians are Asian feminist theologians. So they're kind of in that liberation theology world as well. And again, there's a million other ones, but ultimately at the end of the day, liberation theology, I would say, is just a theology that's done from the experience of being oppressed.
Yeah. Which sort of feels like it's like theology that is aware of like Exodus and like has read Deuteronomy and, you know, yeah, and has read some Isaiah. Like
right.
That's actually.
Yeah. And I talk about this like as if this kind of way of thinking about theology is brand new, right? As an academic discipline, yeah, it's fairly new from the 1960s, but you see the themes of that throughout all of history, not just even in the Christian tradition, but even outside of the Christian tradition as well. You have these themes of thinking about God, thinking about the world from the experience of somebody who is oppressed.
Excellent. Next up, we have process theology, a fun one.
Yes, my go-to. Yeah, so the way I often describe process theology, if it's like my elevator speech version of it, is process theology focuses on two things. The first of which is that the world is open to all sorts of different possibilities in the future, right? So it's kind of the opposite of the Reform world. You know, a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, grew up in that Reform Calvinist world where everything's predestined, right? God has, we're sort of like a video game where we just know what's already going to happen, and we're just living through the simulation of what's already predetermined to happen. Process theology is just the opposite. The future is completely open to all sorts of different possibilities. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that everything in the world, including God, is in a relationship. Okay. So the electrons that make up every single thing in the universe, those electrons have a relationship with one another. Obviously, you go up in scale and you start getting into our cells have a relationship with one another. Our organs do. Human beings have a relationship with one another. And process theology would go as far to say that whole ecosystems have relationship with one another. And you go even further and God is in relationship with the entire world. So everything's in relationship and the world is open to all sorts of possibilities in the future.
Nice. That was that. Have you given that literally on an elevator at some point?
Not on an elevator, but I've given it to a lot of people on a podcast.
It sort of relates to an idea that we found really early on unavoidable is like the course of the Bible. God is constantly presented as not in 5 years, this will happen. In 100 years, this will happen. God is worrying, right. Expecting, anticipating, waiting, hoping, yeah. Fearing, changing. Dreading, changing, yeah. Regretting. Like yeah. God is presented as actively interacting with a world in motion. It feels just like liberation theology, a thing that's like, it's there.
It's totally there.
It's there.
Yeah, one of the founders of process theology, his name is John Cobb. He often says that orthodox theology is a betrayal of the Bible. So he would argue that process theology is more biblical than the orthodox theology of God being unchanging, God being completely unmoved. In fact, that brings me to a fun point that, you know, I forget who it was. It might have been like Thomas Aquinas or somebody made this phrase that God is the unmoved mover, right? In process theology, there's the kind of this whole little phrase that calls God the most mover, meaning that God is the one that has changed the most. You know, when people are being oppressed, when somebody whose loved one dies, God is the one who is most affected in a moment like that, who is, you know, really empathetic, if you will, to those kind of moments that are happening in the world. So, yeah, I think process theology is absolutely all throughout Scripture. It's just there.
If God is infinite, then God has infinite capacity for change, right? Like, isn't it just like sort of intrinsic?
Yeah, so process theology would say there's two different things. There are the There's sort of a primordial nature of God, which means that God is always going to love. In every single moment, God is always going to will the world towards something that is loving. God is always going to be good, right? Those kind of things are part of what process theology calls the primordial nature of God. So those are the things that are just always going to be a part of God. But the way God loves, the way that the goodness of God happens in the world, that could always change. And so that is what is called the consequent nature of God in process theology. And so you kind of have both happening, right? I think that process theology calls it the dipolar, meaning two natures of God, the consequent nature of God and the primordial nature of God. So it doesn't mean that God is sometimes loving and sometimes not. God is always going to be loving, but the way that that love is shown is always going to be different in every situation. You know, the way God shows love to a single-celled organism is going to be different than the way God shows love to someone like myself as a human being.
And it's sort of related to like the Orthodox, the Eastern Orthodox idea, to be specific, that like there's essence of God and there are energies of God. There's like the infinite unknowable mystery. And then there's like the sun rays that actually we can actually interact and engage with. It feels like an idea that like a lot of people have come around to, and that I think solves more problems than like the usual idea of God has built a perfect machine and placed us in it and we can't understand it until the very end, you know?
Right. Yeah, I think there are definitely, certainly there are differences between Eastern Orthodox theology and process theology, but there are a lot of similarities and something that really resonates a lot, I think, with process thought. The other thing I'll mention that process theology gets in trouble with all the time is that, and you might kind of already starting, you might, if you're listening, you might start like, oh, this sounds like it could be a little heretical. So process theology does not believe that God is all powerful. It does believe that God is the most powerful in the world, you know, in reality, but God is not all powerful, meaning that God can't just, if let's say you were driving and you were falling asleep at the wheel and you're headed right towards a semi and you're about to have a head-on crash, God can't just immediately stop that happening in the world. Just by the nature of now, God might will the world. God might do whatever God can do to make something happen so that doesn't happen. But God can't just intervene like that against the will that's happening in the world. And so process theology thinks that God is not all powerful. The reason why I think that's important to think about is that there's this whole problem of evil idea, theodicy, right? Where how can an all powerful and all good God allow evil and suffering to happen in the world? And so process theology's answer to that is, well, God's just not all powerful. and that's kind of how they respond to that kind of problem. So anyway, I think that's a really interesting way of thinking about God. And it certainly, I think, is a reasonable response to the problem of evil, which I think is probably the greatest challenge to theism. Why should you believe in God if evil exists in the world? Well, I think if you believe that God is not all powerful, I think you start to get in a good argument of why theism is worthwhile.
Definitely. Yeah. And it feels like there's lots of potential answers here. Like maybe God is becoming powerful enough to affect the world. And hey, isn't that how Revelation ends, right? Isn't that the ultimate point the ultimate idea of the story is creation made new. Don't we have to work toward that point? And maybe God has to work toward that point as well. And mm-hmm. maybe we're the work. How about that? the final idea that I think would be good for our readers to be aware of is probably the one nearest to me as a person who grew up hellfire and brimstone would be universalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here's the interesting thing. I think universalism is a very, very, very compelling concept. I also don't know what I believe about the afterlife. I probably don't believe that there's any kind of conscious afterlife. But what I will say is that I find universalism as an interesting concept, mostly because of the way that it should change the way we live in the world. And that is, if the assumption in universalism is that at no point is anyone irredeemable. That's the idea behind universalism. At some point, somebody can be redeemed. And I think that's a really powerful way of engaging the world. If you look at somebody and think, you know what? I think at some point you're just not redeemable. That's going to change the way you interact with that person. Then if you think, you know what? You might be doing me wrong right now, but you are redeemable at some point. Now, that does not mean that redemption is total ignorance to consequences. A lot of people that debate me about this think, oh, well, just universalism. So there's no consequence for evil and sin. No. Actually, I think universalism, I think the really important part of redemption is that there's accountability and consequence to those sort of things. Actually, I think that belief in eternal conscious torment, hell, is the belief that there isn't actual consequence to sin, or there's certainly no accountability to sin, because you're just simply punishing it, right? You're just simply eternally punishing somebody. And that's not consequence. That's not accountability, because accountability implies that somebody could get better. And eternal conscious torment means that somebody will never get better because they are going to be eternally punished. And so that's why I think universalism is really, really intriguing as a concept, because I think it really ought to change the way we interact in the world and behave in the world with other human beings. Because yeah, if we believe that somebody is at some point redeemable, then that's going to change the way that we interact with them, and certainly changes the kind of hope that we should have for other people in the world.
That's a really great way to put it, because universalism, like the idea that, I mean, it's a wide range of ideas, but ultimately, basically the idea that nobody's going to be tortured forever, gets framed as if that's a feelings thing, right? That's lovey-dovey, you're being too nice to everyone, and like you're shirking responsibility, but it being framed as like, okay, we don't know what happens after we die, but this idea emphasizes that we are all in the same boat. Some of us, you know, some of us have made terrible choices, and one way or the other, we'll face accountability for that. We'll have to atone for that. But just the emphasizing that it's not just about hope and good feelings and love and vibes, but it's also just more logically coherent, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. And I just think it's like the way a good parent interacts with a child, right? When a child misbehaves, you don't eternally punish them, right? That's not accountability. What you do as a good parent is you teach them the correct way. You have consequences for them and teach them the correct way. And that's redemption. And I think that is a sort of universalist ethic, if you will, rather than an eternal conscious torment ethic, which is you're just going to be punished and hopefully you learn something from it. I just don't think that's even a good way to interact, you know, as a parent, much less interact with other human beings in the world. So, yeah, that's why I think universalism is a really compelling concept, even if you're not a person that necessarily believes in an afterlife.
Hopefully 700 zillion years from now, you feel bad for like stealing a candy bar when you're 8 years old. And then what? You've improved the universe by feeling bad for it. Okay, so this episode, David and Jonathan, ultimately the reason we wanted to talk to you about this episode is, first of all, because, like, you know, we have a lot of all these other good ideas to sort of float before our listeners, but the David and Jonathan story is one thing that I've seen you troll conservative evangelicals on Twitter about a lot. It's one of your go-tos, I think, as a person who enjoys making sport of people with really terrible ideas and John Calvin avatars. What kind of reactions do you get when you point out, hey, yeah, it's totally possible to you know, to read one of the Bible's most famous characters as being gay, being bisexual, in some way? Like, how do people react to that?
Yeah, well, I'll just first off say, you know, if you read the story of David and Jonathan in the Bible, you know, even those of us who read our Bible every year, you know, you did your 1 year Bible plan, you might have missed it, but like, there is a lot of homoerotic description between David and Jonathan. And a lot of people, I think, just miss that. They think of it as just like, oh, these people were really, really close friends. And that very well could be the, you know, who knows? I don't know. But I do think it's kind of interesting that there is kind of this like homoerotic relationship that could be interpreted in those passages. And yeah, you know, with these homophobic conservative dude bros, it's so fun to like point that out. And yeah, so their counter argument is the fact that like, oh, these are just men who are having a really close relationship, and we should encourage relationships, you know, close relationships between men, which is so hilarious to me, because like, I think one of the really core pieces to toxic masculinity is that men can't actually have close emotional relationships with one another. Like, that growing up in that kind of environment, I didn't feel like I was allowed to be close with other men in that way. And so like, I don't need conservative dude bros who are homophobic to teach me about what, you know, about having close emotional relationships with men. Like, they're very invested in a way of thinking about masculinity that prevents that from happening. So I don't need to be lectured by them about that at all. So yeah, that's typically the argument that they'll make between my silly ridiculousness about making fun of that story.
You make a really great point about male friendships, because I'm trying to imagine what it would have been like if I saw two Christian men when I was, you know, in an evangelical church, like hugging and kissing and crying on each other's faces and stuff, as David and Jonathan do.
Especially privately.
Yeah, like going off into the woods to hug and kiss and stuff. How that would have been described, like, no pastor would have said, oh, they're just very good friends, right? There would have been a big council, and like,
right,
you know, they would have been a big, so like, if you're going to say these guys are just friends, then it has to be okay for two guys to love each other in this way. Which is it, right?
Right, exactly. And that's why I just find their argument ridiculous, because that's clearly not how they are operating in the world. So if you're not operating that way, then like, that's not an actual argument you really believe. So yeah, I totally agree.
They I think the other thing they do is which at least I've seen this in sort of other online discourse, sort of the Frodo and Sam is sort of the cousin discourse of this one. one.
Oh yeah.
Someone says Frodo and Sam might have been more than friends. They immediately get responded to with the C.S. Lewis. It's a quote and a meme about like anyone who can't imagine people being just friends is a deviant or whatever. You see this, it's like 8 replies. Everyone is the C.S. Lewis meme. And I just imagine this this happens in David Jonathan discourse as well. But yeah, Frodo and Sam, and then a few of stories from like mythology, like go through my mind as I read like David Jonathan, the ancient, like described by historians as very close friends kind of stories. Right.
Right. I mean, I've heard it. I don't remember who it was, but there's some guy, I guess, that Abraham Lincoln frequently traveled with and stayed in the same bed. And I don't remember who it was. Historians can correct me on that. But yeah, like you hear that often too. It's like, oh, they were friends. Sure, Jan.
Which part do you think bothers the fundamentalist brain more? Is it, and they might be equal, which is it might, is it the idea that King David might have been bisexual, or is it the idea that it's okay to read a Bible story differently than everyone else read, like the idea that it's okay for a Bible story to have multiple meanings?
Oh, I think they hate both of those equally. I don't know if they hate one more than the other, but yeah, The funny thing too is, like, you know, it's not like David is like some minor character in the Bible too, right? Like he wrote, you know, a number of passages that we have in scripture, a number of books. And also, David is like the guy that's described as the man after God's own heart. Right. And I remember having posters like that was almost over Jesus and even maybe over Paul, the person that you look up to the most, like your favorite character as a boy growing up is David, because he's the man after God's own heart. And to think that that guy also had this seemingly homoerotic relationship with a guy named Jonathan. I think conservative dude bros are, it's funny because they like really pigeonhole themselves, because like they really look up to this guy. And also there's this part of him that they're going to have to wrestle with. But also, yeah, the fact that there could be multiple meanings, certainly they're not going to enjoy a way of thinking about their faith in that way either.
Yeah, they try to nail the story down like it has just one meaning and it happens to be the one that we like, right?
No other way to interpret it.
Yeah, that is a really good point you make about like David is like, this is the manly guy who killed Goliath and he might have had a boyfriend. Both these things, you know, this very well might be the case that both these things were true. I feel like I recall having awkward questions for Sunday school teachers, or like someone like says like, hey, wait a second, you know, like there's like these sparks of recognition that like there's multiple ways to read this story. I feel like young Christians just notice what is happening in the story, or to be clear, what is interpretable as happening in the story.
Right.
And then just get snuffed out, you know?
Of course. And yeah, this is not the only story that that's like. I mean, there's a million other. I still remember that I've been like 7, maybe 8 years old and reading through Genesis. And I started like kind of, you know, the wheels are turning about what that could mean about God creating the world and what that looked like and all of that. And I still remember my dad like quickly like, nope, this is how you need to think about this. And, you know, pulling out all the Ken Ham arguments. But I remember like, that's not where my mind was going, but I guess this is the way I got to believe this. So that's kind of interesting.
You also make a good point about conservative Christian men holding up David. Here are two more things they do with David, right? They David's sin with Bathsheba, they hold that up as an example of like, look, see, fallen pastors can be restored, right? Like the right. Pastor I grew up with had sexual assault accusations. And they say, no, he's fine because look, David was restored, right?
Right.
At the same time, they hold up that example of David as like, this is a real thing that happened. And then they deny what appears to be a real thing happening previously in David's life.
Right.
It's both super real and like, there's nothing to learn from this. You know, it's too vague. No, you know,
one of the least vague stories in the Bible so far.
Yeah. It's the clearest romance in the Bible story. So in my opinion, it's like you compare this to like every quote unquote biblical marriage between a man and a woman, short of like Jacob and Rachel. This is more romantic than all the other ones combined. If this is just a friendship, then it is a evocative friendship. But
right. I would actually really like to see a conservative who first off recognizes that David likely raped Bathsheba, but also that he, like, the other sin of David was the fact that he had this homoerotic relationship with Jonathan. Like, I really would love you know, like if you're willing to accept that he raped Bathsheba, like, okay, that's a sin, David was wrong there, then at least that opens up the possibility of like, oh, he he committed the sin of homosexuality with Jonathan too. Like, that would be like an interesting type of a conservative. I'd be really curious to see what, if one of those exists.
You've invented a new type of fundy. But you know what that does is, it is undeniable that the rape of Bathsheba has consequences. You have a prophet going up to David and saying, you have done wrong, right? Jonathan, God's fine with that. So like, in that reading, there are no, you know.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, it doesn't come across that this story is one of sin.
Yeah, like in that
reading. That's true.
At this point in the story.
But it'd be funny if the fundy like interpreted like sin actually being a part of the story, even though it's not very clear in the text at all. That would be really interesting.
The punishment of Jonathan and David, of David for Jonathan, is Saul's righteousness. Like, what? You're talking yourself in pretzel nuts here.
Like, that's where I'm like, I wish I would love to see the kind of like, and I could see maybe like a Jordan Peterson type of Christian doing this, of like the reason why they're not Christian is because, or maybe like a Jordan Peterson type, but not a Jordan Peterson type of Christian, but like one of those like kind of, you know, Joe Rogan people that's like, oh, the reason why I'm not a Christian is because in Acts 4, it sounds a lot like communism and I hate communism. So yes. I'm not going to be a Christian. Like, I'm waiting for that type of guy to exist. Haven't seen it quite yet. So I'm kind of waiting for the type of fundy to exist. That's like, oh yeah, like that was a sinful relationship that David and Jonathan had.
Yeah. I wonder if the reason, I would bet there have been some who've realized that and then realized like, wait, no, but it wasn't public punished, which like David's other sins were, which means it was fine. Uh-oh, never mind. Nothing to see here. So I think sort of in general, zooming out a little bit, you mentioned Rachel Held Evans. She has one of my favorite quotes on the subject of biblical interpretation. It's about like reading scripture with the bias of love. Like when we have these situations where we could err in one way or the other, well, which one feels more like love? Which one feels more like Jesus? I think about that when I read about people who deny universalism is possible. I think about that when there are people who say, no, there's no way Jonathan and David were anything but friends. Is there something to be said for always reading scripture, no matter which book or story, through a filter of hope? Like, whether you're able to say this is definitely true or that's definitely true, of, I guess, erring in the name of love.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's exactly the kind of, if you're wanting to use big seminary words, that's the kind of hermeneutic that should live with, right? The hermeneutic of love, of always erring towards that. And we could be wrong about it, but at least erring towards love, I think, is going to maybe get us a little closer to what God is desiring in the world. It relates actually to one of my other favorite, my favorite quote of Rachel Held Evans. She's got this quote. I don't know if it was in one of her books. I think it was like an interview she did once, but she says, I'm a Christian because the story of Jesus is the story I'm willing to risk being wrong about. And I think that's the kind of way we should live, you know, in the world. You don't have to be a Christian, but I think erring towards love is something that we should be willing to risk to be wrong about. We could be wrong. That's fine. But if we're erring towards love, you know, maybe it's actually something that's actually worth that risk to do. And so, yeah, I totally agree. And that's how I think we absolutely should be engaging scripture.
I think that's a great quote. I think it's from Inspired. It also comes to mind, Zach Lambert, a pastor in Austin, he posted something the other day about like,
also, he was a former college football player, by the way. You should get him on the podcast.
Man, I cannot avoid them. But he posted something the other day about like, how do you know if theology is good? Well, look for the fruit of the Spirit. Does it inspire love, joy, peace, hope, gentleness, self-control, so on and so forth? And like that.
And toxic masculinity, is that the other fruit of the Spirit?
Yeah, it's down the list. I think it took Paul a while to get to that one, but it's in there. I'm sure of it. But like, if that is the guiding light, right? And that's what the Bible says. If that is the guiding light, then does it really matter which creed you're following, which denomination, is it whatever causes you to live with those fruits is the right theology for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So yeah, it's interesting to sort of those ideas coming together. I think on the subject of David and Jonathan, and particularly as someone who has interviewed a wide range of people with a wide range of like faith experiences, how important do you think it is for people who have been marginalized for any reason to be able to see themselves represented in scripture?
Yeah, I mean, I think that piece to it is really, really important because and a lot of times you see God working on behalf or God calling those folks. You see God wanting liberation for these folks. And so to see God in the Bible working on behalf, doing whatever God can do for the liberation of these folks, I think is really, really powerful for people who then can see themselves like, hey, I'm experiencing this sort of same imperial power. I'm experiencing the same oppression that maybe the Israelites are experiencing, or certain characters in the Bible are experiencing, and to see, oh, God is working on their behalf in the Bible. So that must mean that God is working on my behalf as well. I think that's really powerful. There's so many times in our lives where if we see ourselves represented in a story, we're like, oh, like me too. Like there's something really, really powerful of that reflection of, oh, I'm not the only one. There's me too. I remember again, like having these questions and doubts about my faith, literally having no idea that there were other Christians out there that had those same types of questions and doubts, and reading Rachel Held Evans or Nadia Boltz Weber for that first time and realizing, oh, there's at least two others of us. That's nice. So there's something really powerful in that. Oh, I'm not alone in this. And I think for marginalized people to see their stories in scripture as well allows them to have that reflection. Oh, I'm not the only one. And that gives you hope to keep fighting for another day.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Hagar, the story of Hagar in Genesis is like,
yeah,
it's this very brief moment, but so many people have said like, here is an enslaved woman, you know, in hardship. And she is one of the very first people in the Bible that God speaks to, you know, one of the very, very first that God speaks to in like sort of a paternal loving kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find all these moments all throughout the Bible.
Yep.
As long as you do just a little bit of looking.
Yeah. It's really incredible. So yeah, I love reading scripture through those lens. And there's some really good resources. One of the better ones out there that really engages scripture in that way is it's called Womanist Midrash. And it's it was written by Dr. Will Gaffney, and she's an incredible biblical scholar. But yeah, she writes through those lenses. She certainly talks about Hagar in that story. And again, she's talking about it through this lens of being an oppressed Black woman in the world. And so again, I think a lot of people then can hear her story and the way she's interpreting scripture in that way and think, oh, that's a lot like my story. Me too.
I'm glad you cited her by name, because I think I might have read that in her and forgot exactly where I pulled it from. But there, we cited her work. Last question for you, and thank you for your time. As someone who, you know, knows a lot more about theologians than I do, are there theologians you'd recommend for, you've named a bunch, but any others you'd recommend for our listeners, just to challenge the idea that like talking about God and thinking about God has to be like the business of white guys with big hats?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's so many really great people out there. It's hard to name them all. The few that come to mind right away for me, the first is Dr. Roberto Henderson Espinoza. They've written a number of different books. They're a queer theologian, they're ethicist, and you know, they come from the academy in that world, but they write books in a really great way that, you know, integrating their story, their memoir. And I think a lot of people can, again, really relate to what Dr. Roberto has gone through in life and how that connects to how we should think about God and the Bible and all of that. So that's one person who I really respect, who I've had on my podcast a number of times. Somebody who really changed my life was Brian McLaren. I think he's got a million books out at this point. And he recently had a book called Why You Should Stay Christian, or Why Should I Stay Christian? And he has these different approaches. Like, there's good reasons not to stay Christian, there's good reasons to stay Christian, and here they are. I think that's a great book to start with if you're really in that space of, do I want to still be a Christian or not? I think that's a really great resource. So he's another one. I'm trying to think some other really great folks. I mean, I've just had so many good ones on my podcast. I'm trying to think of all.
Avoid like snubbing anyone. We just say in general, look through the list on Mason's podcast and you'll see just a ton of names that.
You know, yeah. Like it's really hard. It's like, you know, choosing your favorite child, which I don't know, maybe is easy for some parents, but it's really hard to
choosing your favorite child.
That's right. So yeah, and some of them might even become a savior someday. But yeah, it's hard to like, I feel like I'm snubbing so many people. I feel like the college playoff committee I'm trying to make this decision right now. So, but those are just two names that come right to mind. I've interviewed them before, but God, there's so a million others out there. They're so great. But I would like to think that a lot of them have been on my podcast too.
Yeah. It's an unfair question. I should have worded it in like, you know, from the standpoint that every everyone you've talked to is great and wonderful, and you know the listeners should check out. But there we go. There, we've named all of them now, technically. So there.
That's right. They've all been named.
Well, thank you, Mason. This was excellent. Always fun to talk to you. Where can listeners find you online?
I'm very active on Twitter and Instagram. You can follow me, Mason Meninga. All one word. That's my handle. I'm also very active, or I'm trying to become more active on YouTube. I make videos of this kind of thing, just talking about faith and theology and different ways of thinking about things. And so you could follow, you know, subscribe, like, and subscribe. I think that's what you're supposed to say. And follow me on there. There'll be more videos coming out here soon. And you can check out my podcasts, People's Theology, if you're interested in theology stuff. And if you grew up in that Christian music world, interview lots of your favorite artists, some of whom are some of the coolest people in the world. And sometimes we do really fun episodes like the Fantasy Drafts. And so, yeah, check that out. Both of those podcasts are very active, uploading quite often. So, I'm very much an online person. So, yeah, always feel free to reach out to me if you got any questions or anything. And I always love hearing what you think about different episodes and all of that. So, yeah.
Thank you, folks, once again for listening to the Vacation Bible School podcast. If you would like to support this show, we are on Instagram at VBS Podcast. I don't know if Twitter will still exist by the time you hear this. We're there, too. We also have a Patreon feed where we do monthly bonus episodes on they're usually not on very specifically Bible stuff. They're often on like more modern stuff, Christian world stuff, evangelical stuff, just a change of pace type things. And, you know, often in our Discord, people will like recommend topics and stuff like that. And we sometimes do like Q&As with like Twitter, Discord, questions and stuff. But yeah, thank you for listening. I have been Jason Kirk.
And I am still Emily Kirk.
We'll see you next time when King David ascends toward the throne. I don't want to say to, because I don't want to guarantee the next episode gets all the way to the throne. Let's just say toward.
We're going to talk about David for a long time.